You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly look at the AL Central. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Thanks for tuning in. The red-hot Indians took the lead in the Central this past week. We'll talk to Jordan Bastian about their staying power. We'll see what Jeffrey Flanagan has to say about the Royals team the Tribe swept last weekend. And we'll get Scott Merkin's take on the big trade the White Sox made for big game James Shields. We'll also get the latest on the Tigers and Twins from Jason Beck and Rhett Bollinger. Thanks for tuning in. Away we go. Jeffrey, the Royals had a very rough weekend here in Cleveland. Four-game sweep at the hands of the Indians. Drops them into second place. And, you know, Ned Yost made the point after Sunday's game that, look, they were coming off an undefeated homestand, and they pitched well within that. So it's not exactly time for panic or anything like that. But it is noticeable. The rotation ERA is now up to 4.86 after Chris Young's performance on Sunday. And, you know, last year this club got away with a pedestrian or even sub-pedestrian ERA out of the starting five. This year it's been, even ramped up another notch as far as the difficulty of the rotation. What are your thoughts on how that's all shaken out and the upside there going forward?
Well, there is no place to go, but probably it's been that bad. But just lately, mainly, I mean, there have been some bright spots, too. I mean, Danny Duffy has looked very good, taking over the number four spot. They haven't really secured the number five spot yet. Ian Kennedy's been pretty solid. You know, Eddie Volquez has gone through some slumps. The real big enigma, you know, probably has been Yordano. Ventura just can't seem to quite get him settled in. So that all has to kind of get fixed. It doesn't have to be great, as we've talked about many, many times with their bullpen and their defense. They don't need, you know, five Clayton Kershaws in there, but they do need guys to, you know, start going to the sixth inning and keeping them in games more often. That certainly didn't happen much over the weekend, although Thursday night game is a game that kind of haunts them. They have the lead late in the game, and that's usually a game they put away. They did not. And I think there's a little bit of a hangover effect from that game. But Chris Young, yeah, he's been he was very good coming back from the DL at two strong outings in relief, and his first start back was pretty good for four innings, and then boom, 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 and you know, the fifth inning is a total disaster, and he's giving up home runs again. So Ned kind of attributed that to just fatigue, trying to stretch him back to 80 to 100 pitches, and that's where he ran into trouble, but something certainly to keep an eye on.
Yeah, Chris Young has now allowed 17 home runs and 41 innings of work this year, not a great ratio, and his ERA is now up to 6.37. So a guy who was a tremendous contributor to pitching staff last year has had his unexpected struggles here in 2016. But, yeah, Jeffrey, you know, you mentioned the Thursday game where they blow the late lead and opted to rest Wade Davis in that game and came back to bite them. They actually did not need Davis the rest of the weekend because of the performance of the starters. But it's interesting. I mean, this club is 11-19 on the road this year. I believe the Twins, Reds, and Padres are the only clubs with worse road records here at this, you know, somewhat early juncture of the season, about a third of the way through the season. We know the Royals are a team built for the home park, but it is pretty striking how they've been two different ball clubs this year.
Yeah, it has been. In the last few years, they've actually been very good on the road. So this is kind of strange for them. They had a bad career in New York, where they lost 3 out of 4, and obviously what is it now, 7 out of 8 for the Indians, something like that, or
yeah.
6 out of 8 in Cleveland. I don't think they want to see Cleveland anytime soon. So, there have been places they've played well on the road. There have been places they have not played well. So it's a long season, of course, and I expect those numbers to kind of even out.
So we talked a little bit last week about, I asked you the question of Whit Merrifield had basically supplanted Omar Infante at second base. Sure seen that way, and then Infante made a defensive miscue that was costly in Thursday's loss. Hasn't distracted the All-Star game voters at all. Infante's actually second in the first ballot update. He was second at second base behind Jose Altuve. So second on the Royals depth chart and second in All-Star game voting. Pretty interesting that dynamic there. But is it safe to say, especially after that defensive issue Thursday, I mean, it certainly seems like a foregone conclusion. We're going to be seeing a lot more of Merrifield, a lot less of Infante.
Yeah, I think that's for sure. And that became more evident on Sunday against Kluber because Omar actually has hit Kluber very well in the past, had a big day against him last year, and we don't see him at all in the lineup. So What we've seen from Whit Merrifield, and obviously he's been an offensive spark getting in the number two spot. He's got a lot more speed. It can make things happen on the bases, and they need that right now. And I think all they were looking for is can Whit defend at second base and be that guy. And so far we've seen he is, and he's actually shown some really good range. So Ned hasn't officially announced that yet, but I would suspect that we're going to see a lot less of Omar, especially after that very costly miscue on Thursday. And he's had troubles all year, you know, turning the double play, and that was a big one not to turn and cost him a run, may have cost him the game. And so, you know, it's probably not a hard decision if you're a manager to go with the hot bat and the hot glove.
Merck, obviously, since we last spoke, we talked a bit about the rumors surrounding the White Sox and James Shields last week, and since then we've got an actual deal. Shields will make his first start for the Sox on Wednesday night. Tell me about this acquisition and what it means for the rotation.
You know, I think it's a good move. It's an addition where they got a guy who is, what, 9 straight years of at least 200 innings pitched, at least 30 starts and at least double-digit victories. I don't know. I don't think anyone's ever gotten triple-digit victories, so I think we can leave at least out of that one. And, you know, they don't need him to be a top-of-the-rotation guy as he was in his prime at Tampa or anything like that. They just need him to be a consistent starter that can go deep into games, and it's going to help the starting rotation. It's going to help the bullpen, and it should help the team overall. And the best thing is, you know, as baseball goes, they didn't pay a huge price to acquire Mr. Shields. You know, Eric Johnson has the makings of a solid starting pitcher. I think he'll do better in the National League, and I don't think his future was with the White Sox rotation at this point. And Fernando Tatis Jr., you know, good bloodline. I've heard good things about him as a very young, unproven player. He was an international signing. And the thing is, though, you know, they're so young at that age that it's almost hard to project out. You know, and that very few unless you're a Julio Urias, you know, hard to project out for a guy at 17, whether he's going to be a major leaguer or maybe not even get out of AAA. So, you know, San Diego would take that chance, and San Diego likes the prospect they got. The Sox certainly weren't looking to get rid of him, but in the scheme of things, not giving up Tim Anderson or Carson Fulmer or Spencer Adams and getting, you know, a pitcher back like this was a very good move for the White Sox.
Yeah, when you look at the cost of pitching on the open market, what their financial obligation here is pretty limited, obviously, and plays well, especially if he can give you that durability. I said this last week.
I should throw that. I forgot that, you know, they're paying him of his salary. They're paying $5 million this year. They're paying $10 million next year, $10 million the year after that, and then they're on the hook for the $2 million buyout if they don't pick up his option at that point. So, you know, basically – a good chunk of 3 seasons for $27 million, which a pitcher of that ilk, that's pretty reasonable for, you know, just to make that, to commit that kind of money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I said this last week, my only hang up with Shields, especially on this team and this home park, is, you know, big game James has been big fly James, especially the last couple of years. With the home run rate, even pitching his home games in Petco Park. So I almost wonder if, because there are some, you know, bigger or fairer ballparks in the AL Central, Detroit, Kansas City, Cleveland plays pretty fair. I almost wonder if they'll kind of tailor his schedule around that as best they can.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure about that. I agree with you that, you know, U.S. Cellular can play very small during the summer months, but there seems to be fewer and fewer summer days as we go in Chicago here. And as Navarro was joking the other day, you know, Deonor Navarro has caught him more than any other catcher in his career. And he said, you know, he's lucky he missed April around here and parts of May when it was like 45 degrees and rainy pretty much every day. Maybe not every day, but quite a few days. But, yeah, I don't know if they're – I think they trust him. And, if, you know, I think they'd rather have him keeping his style, challenging hitters, and, you know, giving up a home run here and there as opposed to start walking guys and, you know, picking around the zone. So I think he's been around a lot enough. They know who he is. They know what he's about, and they're going to take the chances. But you're right. I mean, you know, that you can – especially with the All-Star break coming up and a few off days here and there, you can switch things around to kind of, you know, tailor it to make his schedule a little more conducive for his style.
With Shields in the rotation, Matt Latos remains in the rotation as well, and Miguel Gonzalez goes to the bullpen.
Gonzalez actually had better numbers over the last month or so than Latos. Latos had that great April and has since fallen back considerably in the statistical department. So what went into that decision, Murph?
Yeah, I don't think this is stamped as in, you know, this is it for the rest of the year, see in October. I think right now they just feel like Gonzalez is the better fit working out of the bullpen. Yeah, I think they have looked at Latos's overall body of work, and I think I read in the MLB Network pregame notes that they're 8-2 in games that he started. Even though, you know, he hasn't been great the last, I guess, like six starts it is now. Awesome his first four, a little shaky the last six. But I mean, they just felt like as a better overall mix, Gonzalez worked better out of the bullpen, and Latos for now is going to be the fifth starter. And again, you know, the same thing with Shields, where he's coming in and you're not saying he's a, you know, a number one or number two guy. You know, Latos is now the fifth starter. And again, I don't think Latos is going to go out there and say, well, I'm a fifth starter now, so I can do whatever. If I get five innings and three runs, that's a heck of a start. But I think the little even less pressure on him than there was at the start of the season. So that's how they like it right now. They already used Gonzalez out of the bullpen Sunday because they were still a little shorthanded. And I think it's, you know, something to change as they move on. I think if Latos goes out and let's use the bad hypothetical and Pitt makes three starts and gets lit up in all three, I'm sure they can readjust and change things. Although, you know, Gonzalez will be working shorter amounts of time than he was the starter, obviously.
JB, the Indians had a huge weekend against the Royals. They've now won 6 of 7 against the defending champs, all at Progressive Field. Outscored the Royals 37-18 in those seven games. Really, you got to beat the best to be the best, and the Tribes, we talked about before, but they're really taking care of business against AL Central opponents this season.
Yeah, that's been huge. It's been a big difference over some recent years, and obviously there's a long way to go, but I think the Indians kind of had a sense that this felt like more than just a regular series. You know, they tasted first place last week and then were knocked back a couple games with a rough stretch to the start of the homestand. Then Kansas City was coming in right on the heels of a pretty emotional walk-off win for the Indians on the day that Marlon Byrd got suspended. They had a walk-off win, and that was, you know, gave the team a big lift on a pretty rough day. And then Kansas City was coming into town as a first-place team, and I think, you know, they kind of looked at that as a chance to kind of quickly move on over some rough patches, both in terms of win-loss and things happening with the team. And man, boy, did they ever. They finished the homestand with that four-game sweep of the Royals, moved a game and a half up on Kansas City in the division, and have kind of asserted themselves here as a team that's, you know, plans on sticking around. And they're doing this without Michael Brantley. They've done this without Carlos Carrasco for a good chunk, although he's back on the rotation now. So very impressive series overall. I think just they overwhelmed Kansas City both on the pitching and offensive side.
Yeah, we'll talk about Carrasco in a second, but 18-7 against AL Central opponents. They were 32-43 last year, so huge improvement there. But you mentioned the Marlon Byrd suspension, and, you know, obviously this guy wasn't, you know, counted on to be a key cog in their lineup. He was a million-dollar signing, and, you know, hope they get some power out of his 38-year-old body, that sort of thing. But it still affected that clubhouse, did it not? I mean, some guys were saying this is a guy who was well liked in that room and well respected in that room, and you know, he did deliver some solid contributions offensively in the early going. So you know, that while this wasn't a you know, a huge contributor, this was certainly a guy they were counting on.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's disappointing. They already went through this with Abraham Almonte during spring training. You know, so to go through it a second time in terms of a PED suspension, you know, that's rough, especially when those are both guys that were going to be counted on with the knowledge that Michael Brantley was going to be out for a significant amount of time. I think that, you know, maybe it's a blessing in disguise in a way. Tyler Naquin can come up and get some regular playing time again, and, you know, he looks a little more comfortable right now, but definitely disappointing. I think, you know, Byrd handled it as well as he could in the wake of that, you know, getting up in front of his teammates and speaking about it and apologizing and kind of with his teammates taking accountability for the fact that he's the one who put the stuff into his body and trusted people other than himself to know what was in the products that he was putting in his body, and obviously came back to bite him. So it was a big blow. It was, I think at the time they signed him during spring, it already was a situation where there were some guys in the clubhouse who weren't sure about it because strictly a timing thing. You're midway through camp. You know, you've shown, you know, there are players who, you know, would have liked to see loyalty, you know, shown to them who have been there from the beginning. So, you know, there were some people that were upset, but there were also guys in that clubhouse who said, yeah, let's bring this guy in. He's a veteran. He's experienced. And we need to do whatever it takes to win. You know, so to have it kind of backfire in this way, there definitely was, you know, some upset parties within that clubhouse. But like I said, you know, when you kind of have a walk-off win that day and then sweep the Royals, you can quickly move on from that bad storyline and kind of shift the focus elsewhere. I think we'd be having a different tone to this conversation if Kansas City would have came in and swept the Tribe.
Yeah, and Naquin helped change the conversation. You know, the
right
thing when a veteran guy at the tail end of his career, you know, does something like Bird did, knowingly or unknowingly, it hurts the guys on the fringes, like Tyler Naquin, who was riding that bus between Columbus and the big leagues earlier this season. And so he comes back up, and that's why I loved about his weekend. You know, he was the guy who probably was most affected by Bird's presence on the roster. And then he comes back and hits the three homer, first three career home runs. He goes 6-for-11, I believe it was, in the sweep of the Royals. So I don't know. I don't know if that power can sustain JB based off of his minor league numbers. But to your point earlier, I mean, he certainly looked comfortable up there.
Yeah, I think the first homer he hit, his first career homer, was definitely encouraging in terms of the power that you mentioned, just because the nature of it. It was an opposite field shot over that 19-foot wall at Progressive Field, and we were talking to Chisenhall. You know, he said he doesn't remember a lot of left-handed hitters who have hit balls that hard to that spot of the ballpark. So that's kind of encouraging. And I think, you know, maybe now that Naquin knows the landscape a little bit better, you know, as Terry Francona has mentioned multiple times over the last few days, just how much more relaxed and comfortable Naquin has looked. I think he experienced the joy of making an opening day roster and everything that went along with that, and then having success in the big leagues, you know, hitting around 300. But then he also experienced that learning curve of, hey, when you're the young guy on the roster with minor league options, the game is also a business, and you're going to be sent back and forth sometimes, and you're going to get some, you know, maybe some tough lessons in those meetings before you go back to the minor leagues on what you need to work on. And I think some of those trips down, you know, took a toll on him in terms of just, you know, his reaction to it. I know he missed one of the road trips to Houston, for example, when he had his whole family was planning on coming into Houston. You know, there's, you know, that emotional toll and then everything else that went along with it. But I think now that he's kind of gone through it a couple times, comes to terms with it, and now with Bird out of the equation, can kind of see that he's going to be here for a while. I think that'll help, and I think it showed that it helped in that series against the Royals.
Rhett, Byron Buxton came back to the big league ball club recently and really looked like a different player from what we saw earlier in the season. As of this recording, he's got a hit in all six games since rejoining the club. He's batting .435 with a double and two triples, and he went 3-for-4 with an RBI triple in that loss to the Rays on Sunday. But what are you seeing from Buxton, and what is he saying about his resurgence here?
Well, he definitely looks a lot more comfortable in that first round, obviously. Early in the year, he really struggled. You know, went down to AAA, kind of got his swing back there. The big thing, I think, is he's kind of changed the mechanics a little bit. He changed early in the year, he was kind of doing a toe tap at the plate, and now he's doing more of like a pronounced kind of leg kick, allowing him to kind of drive the ball a little bit more. But really more than anything, I think it's a little bit of a confidence level thing, where his confidence is definitely higher after some success there at AAA. Just looks more comfortable at the plate. As you said, he had a big game there going, you know, 3-for-4. Showed some good signs with the triple off the wall, which is the right field, so he's driving the ball the other way. He dropped down, you know, a bunt for a hit in that game as well. And he also got a hit there with two strikes on an 0-2 count. Just kind of was able to lift the ball into the shallow right field for a bloop hit, but still a good sign to be able to kind of, you know, fight off an 0-2 pitch like that, because in the past, you know, anytime he was down 0-2, he was pretty much done for with a strikeout. So he still has some strikeouts here and there so far in this, you know, kind of second go-around. And no walks, which is a little bit concerning, but more than anything, I think just the contact level is way up. He's showing that he can bunt and showing off that speed. I think his triple he hit a couple days ago, you know, was the second fastest, you know, home to third, you know, in terms of his speed that he showed. I think he ran 21 miles per hour. So the speed is definitely there. It's just a matter of putting the ball in play, and so far he's definitely been able to do that.
Yeah, it just seems like so much of this club moving forward this season, and obviously their place
in the standings being what it is, it seems like there's so much tied to, all right, let's at least get some major development out of Byron Buxton. Am I wrong?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the whole thing. You know, the way the season's going right now, not just Buxton, but maybe see what they have in Max Kepler right now. He's playing a lot in right field.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these young guys, I'm sure Berríos could be up again at some point. He's coming off a pretty good start here. I think once the season goes along, I think we're going to see a lot of that. We're going to start seeing a lot of these young guys get more playing time just because at this point, as you said, it is a little bit of a lost season in terms of the fact they're not going to, you know, come back from this deficit to make the postseason, but they can still develop guys and know that next year obviously can be a lot better than this year.
You mentioned Kepler coming up and basically chosen over Eddie Rosario, who had recently gone down. What was the thought process when they kind of prep out those two guys?
Well, Rosario, to his credit, is swinging the bat a lot better at AAA, but I think the big problem there, too, is he's kind of like with Buxton in terms of just not drawing walks. At least with Buxton, Buxton's shown a history of drawing walks. That's why it's not as much of a concern. But with Rosario, his biggest issue is he's such a free swinger. He's not really, you know, getting on base much, even though he's having success. And so far, I don't believe Rosario has drawn a walk, at least not at the time when they decided to call up Kepler, whereas Kepler was having better plate appearances. And, you know, they're probably a little bit of a wash defensively, both good defenders. I think they weighed both guys. I think they figured that Kepler was having better at bats. I think part of it, too, is that, you know, Rosario was just sent down. I think they want a little bit more time from him to kind of continue to develop as well. So it made some sense. I think they want to kind of finally give Kepler a chance because, you know, last year Kepler came up in September, barely played. He was up early in April this year when Danny Santana won the DL. He barely played. So I think they finally kind of want to see what they have in Kepler and actually give him some extended playing time up here. And we'll kind of see how he does.
Heck, Michael Fulmer, we've talked about him quite a bit in recent weeks on this podcast and obviously was a big trade acquisition for this club last year in the ONS Cespedes deal. But I'd say he's exceeded expectations here his last three times out. He's got a 22 1/3 scoreless inning streak. Just two Tigers rookie have pitched longer scoreless streaks than what Fulmer has going on. John Hiller holds the record from August 1967 with 28 2/3, and Victor Santos went 25 straight in early 2001. What do you make of what Fulmer's done here the last few times out, Beck?
It's been really kind of a growth process in turbo speed. I think even Tigers officials who were upbeat on his chances of making it as a starter didn't expect him to make the transition as quickly. But, you know, the changeup has really come on for him. It's not just a viable third pitch, but it was a swing and miss pitch Monday night. He was getting, now granted it's an aggressive Blue Jays lineup, but he was getting hitters out in front of it, you know, gross to the point where, you know, he made a couple of those guys really look silly. And you combine that with mid to upper 90s fastball. He didn't even have to go upper 90s Monday night. The slider remains an effective pitch. Here's a guy who right now has got three good above average major league pitches and working with James McCann behind the plate, who he trusts completely. You know, they've really found this combination to throw guys off guard.
Yeah, I know McCann and Jared Soltamaki have really been pushing him to use that pitch as much as possible. It's become quite a weapon, and it really takes him to the next level. You go from 2 to 3. So this rotation has obviously been in flux, and you know Fulmer has kind of cemented his spot in there, Beck. And there's obviously been other bigger changes that you didn't foresee coming going into the season. Anibal Sanchez struggled. Move him into the bullpen. Obviously, the home run has been an issue for him. Getting through the third time of the order, you look at his splits this season and what the damage has been against him that third time through the order. So does this feel like a permanent move, a temporary move? What do you make of Sanchez?
Yeah, on the surface, you just take the move by itself. You would think it's a short-term move to work things out, but you look at where the Tigers are at. You look at the young starters they have kind of on the cusp of taking a rotation spot. You know, Fulmer aside, you know, Matt Boyd is somebody who made an impression in spring training and might have won a rotation spot if there weren't so many veterans there. And even beyond that, I think a lot of us have forgotten about Daniel Norris, who had the inside track on that fifth starter spot. in spring training, at least coming into camp before injuries kind of halted his progress. He's now getting on a roll at Triple-A Toledo. This was a rotation in transition going in, and the way that Sanchez looks, you wonder, unless he really gets on a good streak or unless injuries pop up, if he's going to be afforded that chance to work his way back in the rotation. This might be the start of a long-term transition here. And you know, if Telfrey hadn't gotten turned around, we might have been talking about him as well. But right now, it's just the way Sanchez is pitching. And I think, too, just as big a factor is the confidence factor with him, which has been awfully low really since the year started, maybe even dating back to last season. You know, you can look at the kids and say they give you a better chance to win right now.
Well, offensively, a guy who's really stepped up and given a chance to win is Cameron Maben. His return to the Tigers organization has been a tremendous success, hitting over 400 with an OPS over 900 since coming off the DL a couple weeks back. And Brad Ausmus has moved him up to the two hole. I know you talked recently to Maben about, you know, the kind of way his hitting approach has evolved in his career. When the Tigers drafted him way back when, he's supposed to be a speed and power guy, but it sounds like he's really learned to just become a contact hitter and a good fit for that two-hole right now.
Yeah, he's kind of filled that slot that I think a lot of people envisioned Roger Davis doing the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Like a speed guy, put the ball in play, take advantage of his foot speed, and really kind of force the defense to make mistakes or make plays. It's really provided a jolt to this offense, I think. And it works wherever he seems to be hitting in the order. I know there was some trepidation on Ausmus's part about putting him in the two spot because he worried that it would take away some of the advantage of his speed because he wouldn't necessarily be trying to steal nearly as many bases with Cabrera up. You know, you don't want to open up first base. But I think we've started to see examples now where he can score from first base on the double with ease. And Cabrera, for all the talk about the renewed home run power, is still a guy who does a lot of damage on doubles. So I think it actually gives Cabrera more RBI opportunities, more so than it takes away, you know, stolen base opportunities from Avery.